This is Jazz Talk, presented by Melbourne International Jazz Festival. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which our festival takes place and pay respects to their elders past, present and future, as well to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider Melbourne community and beyond. We are honoured to contribute to over 60,000 years of music making, knowledge sharing and storytelling that has taken place on this land. I'm Chelsea Wilson. Welcome to the Jazz Talk podcast. Recorded live during the 2022 Melbourne International Jazz Festival at the Channel Arts Centre Melbourne, this episode features pianist Dan Tepfer in conversation with Melbourne bassist and composer Tamara Murphy. New York-based Dan Tepfer has earned an international reputation as a pianist-composer of wide-ranging ambition and individuality. He has performed with some of the leading lights in jazz and classical music, from Lee Konitz to Renee Fleming and Ferris Sanders, and is a prolific recording and touring artist. In this conversation, proudly supported by Arts Centre Melbourne, we dive deep into his artistic processes and fascinating technical innovations at the intersections between science and art.
So please welcome Dan Tepfer. He's a pianist based in New York City. He was born in Paris in 82 to American parents and has recorded with musicians such as Lee Konitz, Kneebody's Ben Wendell and Nate Wood, and bassist Thomas Morgan. He's released 10 albums of his own in solo, duo and trio formats. Please correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. He has a diverse musical footprint, incorporating and adapting materials such as the Goldberg variations and improvised variations upon those, jazz standards plus his own compositions, which are absolutely worth checking out if you haven't already. If you want to know more after today, I strongly suggest having a look at his website, where you can find out much more about his coding, Farplay and other apps he's made. We might get onto a bit of that later. His live stream concerts and his blog, which includes, amongst other things, an excellent anecdote about Ruben, his temporary housemate, who also happened to be a tiny squirrel. Highly recommended experience. He's here in Melbourne as part of the Melbourne International Jazz Festival to promote his newest video album, Natural Machines, which he's performing at the Planetarium Wednesday and Thursday this week. I think there's a few tickets left. To quote his website, this project explores in real time the intersection between science and art, coding and improvisation, digital algorithms and the rhythms of the heart. The New York Times has called him a deeply rational improviser drawn to the unknown. Please welcome Dan Tepfer. So welcome.
Thanks so much, Tamara.
Have you been to Melbourne before? Been to Australia before?
Yeah, I've been here twice. I was here in 2018, I think. I played the Canberra International Music Festival. Actually, I played that project that you just mentioned, the Goldberg Variations. And also played a fun trio gig with some Australians. That was 2018. And I just came to Melbourne to play for the Yamaha folks, because I'm a Yamaha artist, and played a few other gigs in Australia. But the previous time, I think, was 2012. And I had this kind of disastrous time here because I came with Lee Konitz. We were supposed to play in the Melbourne Jazz Festival. At the Melbourne Recital Center, if I remember right. Anybody remember that? And I was supposed to be with Kurt Rosenwinkel and my trio, and Lee got severely ill that morning. He had ended up having a subdural hematoma, which is a very serious thing in your skull, and I think he spent over a month in the hospital here in Melbourne. And then he was miraculously kind of okay, and he died at the beginning of the pandemic. So anyway, very happy to be here for the third time in more happy circumstances.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Just for some people who don't know much about you, do you want to tell us a bit about sort of how you got into music or a bit about yourself?
Sure. Lee had this great line. Whenever anybody asked him about himself, he said, "I was born at a very young age." I was like that. Do you guys get that? I didn't hear much laughter. My mom was an opera singer. She sang at the Paris Opera and the Paris Opera Chorus for over 20 years. And so I was literally like bathed in music 9 months before I was born. And my grandfather was a jazz pianist on the West Coast. So I was all surrounded by both classical music and jazz from a young age. And then my dad was a biologist. He was a scientist. And actually in his family, there are a bunch of scientists as well. So I was also surrounded by a lot of science from a young age. And started coding when I was 9 or 10. So then my undergrad was in astrophysics, and then my master's is in music. So these worlds have always like really coexisted for me. But returning to how I got into music, I feel like I've never not been into music. It's just been something I've always been around. And then I started going to the conservatory in Paris where I grew up when I was 6, and but would spend all my time improvising at home. We didn't have a TV, and I didn't have any siblings, and this was before the internet, so that was basically the one thing I could do for fun, play the piano. So I played a lot of piano.
Yeah, nice. So you grew up with a classical influence and a jazz influence as well. How do you think that's informed your sort of music making and obviously your science background? It seems like it's all really present in what you do.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the... It's interesting because I think for a very long time I didn't think any of these things could mix together. So I did study classical piano. I still study classical piano. I never stopped. But anyway, I studied classical piano, but I always thought of myself as a jazz musician for some reason. I mean, even as a kid, I was like, I'm an improviser, you know. That was just always my identity. And so when I first started playing gigs, it was like, I'm a jazz musician. Why would I play any classical music? That's not cool. You know, I just love improvising and playing jazz. But then as I got into my 20s and my 20s, the idea of bringing classical music into what I do as an improviser started making a lot more sense. I started working a lot on the Goldberg variations just for fun. And then I realized that they made unbelievable frameworks for improvisation. And so then that project, Goldberg Variations, was born, and that made me dive a lot more deeply into Bach. I went back and studied counterpoint and harmony much more seriously than I had before with a teacher in New York. And then that, of course, went right back into how I improvise. And so those two worlds started very much belonging together for me, the classical and jazz. And in fact, I think of them completely as the same thing to me now. It's like it's all music, you know. Mm. And it's only more recently that my love of science started, that I realized that that could also coexist. I started writing computer algorithms that generated music. I guess you'd call it generative music. But it was a bit frustrating for me because the results always sounded a bit mechanical. Mm-hmm. But then I discovered the Yamaha Disclavier, which is this piano that's a fully acoustic piano that I'll be playing at the planetarium, but that also has a mechanism that allows it to play all by itself. And I realized that if I used what I was playing as input to my algorithms, then what came out was not mechanical because it was all using the data from what I'm playing, and I'm not a mechanical, I mean, I'm a person, so I'm not a machine. So, that led to this project, Natural Machines, which is kind of the first time that all these things have come together for me.
Mm, awesome. So when you first started, so does everyone get what's going on? So there's a piano that sort of plays itself. You can feed info into it and Dan then can interact with sort of like whatever the piano is doing in real time.
Yeah, but it's actually, like I want to make sure we get the order straight because the piano on its own doesn't do anything. But I've written these algorithms that will react to what I improvise. Mm-hmm. And so then, yes, I'm interacting with it, but it's not like it has anything pre-planned or anything that I'm reacting to if I don't do anything. But then once I start doing something, it becomes a dialogue, right? It's responding, and then it's like, oh, well, that makes me play something else. And
So do you have different algorithms that do different things for different pieces or with the generative music idea?
Yeah. I do, yeah. Mm-hmm. What really fascinates me, this is why this project is called Natural Machines, is because what really fascinates me in music and I think in art in general is this intersection of what I like to call the algorithmic and the spiritual. if you think of somebody like Bach, but this is also true of somebody like Coltrane or Steve Coleman, for example, or somebody like Bartok or Ligeti, there's a hugely important aspect of their music, which is truly algorithmic. And what I mean by algorithmic is just a set of rules that is dutifully carried out. So if you think of Bach, for example, you know, in the Goldberg Variations, of course, the whole thing is supported by the rules of counterpoint, which are really pretty hard and fast rules. I mean, he'll bend them sometimes, but it's very unusual, actually, for him to bend them. So these rules of counterpoint, which are absolutely algorithmic, I've even written a program that generates Palestrina-type counterpoint just based on the rules. And it's amazing how good it sounds just based on those rules. Mm. So there are these very mechanical rules that actually make for good music. So there's that, and then in addition to that, Bach is imposing other rules on himself, such as the rules of canon, like every third variation in the Goldberg Variations is a canon at a rising interval. Additional rules, like in the Goldberg Variations, every variation follows the same harmonic pattern. It's kind of like what jazz musicians do when they're improvising on a standard. They'll play the head, which is like the melody of the song, and then they'll start improvising over the harmonic structure of the song. So it's very similar to what Bach is doing in the Goldberg Variations. So that's another rule. That's three rules already. Another rule is like Bach will never write a bad melody. Every time there's any statement of anything, it's a melody. It's a beautiful melody. That's a rule. So in any case, there are these hard and fast rules supporting it all, right? But Bach is smart enough, as the best artists are, to not let the rules determine everything. In fact, he leaves, you know, really significant degrees of freedom in there that need to be that leave questions open that need to be solved through a mysterious process. And you could call that process emotional or spiritual or intuitive. But that's really where the magic happens, is where you leave enough degrees of freedom open, but then also there's a powerful structure supporting it all. And you see examples of music where this is not done correctly. Like, for example, that's really the problem with total serialism. Like, are you guys familiar with total serialism? I see some nodding and some no's. So the second Viennese school is these composers, Schoenberg, Bergen, Webern, who, right after the First World War, came up with a system. Actually, Schoenberg came up with a system, the idea of which was to make music that had no relation to tonal music. It's a very long tradition of common practice. And the way you do that is an extremely simple rule, which is like you need to play all 12 pitches before you can play any other pitches again. So all 12 pitches are being played all the time. And in the wake of the Second World War, there was a movement led by people like Pierre Boulez that added further rules to that one, and they called it total serialism because not only were the pitches determined, but also things like rhythms and dynamics. So basically, like, there's this mathematical process that would determine the entire piece, and these pieces are like unlistenable. They suck, and like, I think most people agree. I mean, like, there's some wonderful music from that era. In fact, I love Schoenberg's music, Webern and Berg. There's some really beautiful stuff, but the total serialist music, I don't think is gonna
it's
last.
Not gonna take off.
I don't think it's gonna. Well, it's definitely not taking out, but I don't think it's gonna last through history, because I think what's really missing is that moment where a human person has asked themselves, "Does this feel good? Does this sound good? Do I like it? You know, does it convey how I feel?" The spiritual side of the equation is missing. In other words, and in addition to that, there's another problem, which is that the rules of serialism are actually really dumb. Like, if you think of the rules of counterpoint, they're extremely profound because they're based in physics. They're based in...
And there's a logic behind them.
there's the logic that actually goes almost beyond logic. It goes to the, like the rules of the natural world, because it's about how frequencies resonate with each other. Whereas the rules of serialism are actually just like really trivial. So it's like bad rules and no space for spirituality. But with Bach, we have very good rules and a lot of space for spirituality. And so that makes for great music. So anyway, the point with Natural Machines is that I've written these programs that take care of the rules part. So they give structure to everything. And then I'm free to improvise and just kind of navigate these worlds that are created by the rules.
So what are the rules?
Great question. So they could be super simple. And the starting point for this really for me was observing what kind of rules Bach uses. For instance, the first program I wrote was a simple canon at the octave. So it couldn't be simpler. I mean, everything that I play is repeated an octave up or an octave down. But even though that's incredibly simple, I realized that it is meaningful musically because, for example, the variation 24 in the Goldberg variation, sorry, yes, 24, is a canon at the octave in the Goldberg variations. And it has a different vibe from everything else. And in fact, every one of the canons has a different vibe. The previous one's canon at the seventh and canon at the sixth. The point is that even imposing a simple rule on yourself, and this is really, I think, the whole point of rules, draws something out of you as an artist that you would not have expected to come out of you otherwise. We all know that, right? It's like if you're painted into a corner, unless it's a corner you already know, you'll probably find a way to jump out of this corner that you have not thought of before. And so that process leads you to discover new things about yourself, which is wonderful. And so I could feel that in Bach when he's using a canon of the octave. So I said to myself, you know, I think this would be a really interesting thing to explore, even though it's so simple. And what I found when I started playing with it was that it was incredibly fun. It was just very, very playful and just immediately turns everything into counterpoint. And then, of course, there's this big question that comes up with any canon, which is rhythm, right? Like if you have a question and an answer, then how much time is there between the question and the answer? And how many notes do you fit in there? Like if that's what's happening, if this is the question and then this is the answer, do you like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, like you could do so many different things, and you could modulate too within those things. And so one of the things I do with my canon at the octave algorithm is I have some pedals on the ground, and I can multiply the delay between what I'm playing and the answer by one, by 3/2 or by 2/3.
I'm gonna have to do some math in my head. Yeah.
Well, so like let's say that it's like that. And let's say I'm playing eighth notes in between, and there are two of them, right? Daka, 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 daka. But then I multiply it by 3/2, so 1.5. So it's like daka, 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 daka. And then that's my due delay. So I could go, I could change the number of notes. So I have 3 daka, daka. I could do 4 daka, 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 daka. And then let's say I multiply it by 3/2 again. So it's like daka 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 daka, and I have a new delay. So I just love that idea of certain things staying stable and then other things changing beneath it, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like these kind of rotating chains or something. Mm-hmm. But that's like the simplest of the algorithms. So I think the one I wrote after that is the one I call inversion. And it's just the same as that, except that everything gets inverted. So you set an axis of symmetry in the piano, and then everything that I play gets repeated a little later, but upside down. And that just, even though that's like, again, incredibly simple, it raises all kinds of fascinating questions. Because if I want what I play to belong with what the piano plays in response, then I need to start thinking about palindromic modes, right?
Awesome.
Do you guys understand what a palindromic mode is? So what's a palindrome? Yeah. So a mode in music is just a collection of notes. It's really a collection of intervals. And so a palindromic mode is a mode that has the same intervals up and down. So Dorian, for example, is a palindromic mode. You go... If you look at the intervals involved and you go... It's exactly the same intervals. And so if you start on D, for example, and go whole step, then half step, and whole step, and whole step, and whole step, and half step, and whole step, and you go down with exactly that same sequence from D, it's also going to be all the same notes. So in other words, if I set my axis of symmetry on D and I play only white notes, the piano is also going to respond only with white notes. But there are all kinds of modes that are palindromic. There's like Messiaen mode 3s and 4s are palindromic. Actually, all Messiaen modes are palindromic, I think. Maybe not all, maybe not everyone. You know, there are modes of the ascending melodic minor scale that are palindromic, diminished scale. So anyway, the point is these incredibly simple rules immediately raise, I think, very interesting questions. That are just automatically raised by them. It's not like I set out to ask those questions. It's just like they're being asked by the simple rule. And that's what I love about this. Like you set a parameter and then immediately these windows open. Mm. But then, sorry, I'm going to stop talking in just a second, but I just have written a whole bunch of different algorithms that do very different things. But like one of them, for example, is a tree fractal. And I just love fractals, and I wanted to find a way to generate music from fractals. And so as those of you come, we'll see, I have literally a tree made of this fractal idea, and that's playing, that tree is playing the piano. So anyway, like that.
Wow. Have you
Oh, sure. Yeah. So a fractal is an idea that was popularized by Benoit Mandelbrot. You guys may have heard of the Mandelbrot fractal. If you haven't heard of it, you've definitely seen it. It's very famous. And the idea of a fractal is it's an idea in math. It's a very, very powerful idea. It's simply that fractals are mathematical objects that exhibit self-similarity. So what that means is that if you zoom into a part, that part will reflect the whole. And the fascinating thing about fractals is that once people started studying them, and in particular, once people started using computers to be able to see them, because without computers, the amount of computation you need to do to be able to just see what they look like is kind of insane. People had investigated this before computers, but only very simple fractals. Anyway, once you start seeing them with computers, you realize that the natural world is made of fractals. Like everything around us is fractal. It's very, very obvious. And once you start using fractals, it's like, oh, wow, this looks just like nature. So nature is completely fractal. Not even just living things. Like if you look at mountains or shorelines, they're all fractal. And just to come back to this particular fractal that I use in Natural Machines, it's one of the simplest there is. It's just this idea that you take, it's basically the letter Y. So it's like one branch that divides into two. And then, so imagine just a Y with two branches. And then you first of all, you take this Y and then you repeat that Y using the branch of this one as the base for the next Y. Okay, so there's going to be another Y here, and the branch of each one of those is also going to be a little Y. But then what you do is you vary the angle between the branches, and this creates this incredibly beautiful swaying of the tree. And when you look at this, you realize that that's actually how real trees work. And at first in the album, it's a two-dimensional tree that I made. It's like, it's basically what I just described. But then during the pandemic, I turned it into a three-dimensional tree. So instead of a Y, it's like it's a base with three branches coming out of it. And what's interesting about that is that it made the music go from duple meter, so everything is like one, two, to triple meter because of three branches. So it's like one, two, three, one.
So when you say the tree plays the piece or the piano, how does that work?
So that's really the question I had to ask myself originally. It's like, okay, I love the way this looks. I love the concept behind it. How do I turn this into music? And my only goal was to find a way to turn into music that somehow preserved the structure that you see so obviously visually when you look at it. It's very, very obviously beautifully structured. I wanted to make sure that we could hear that in the music. And so I did something very simple, which is basically time is represented by, or time is, so the hierarchy of the tree is represented in time. And what that means is that I'm moving through the nodes of the tree hierarchically. Like in the thing I just described, there's one Y that starts it all, right? So that's like Y number one. And then there's going to be two Ys that are coming off of that one. So those are Ys number two. There are going to be four Ys coming off of those, right? Because each has
like
two branches.
Each level where it doubles.
And doubles. Exactly. Yeah. And that's going to be 8 and 16. And so basically there's a hierarchy to the tree. There are these different levels of depth in it. And so basically over time, we go through all these, we go out into all these hierarchies. And then what pitch do I give every note? I just use how high it is on the screen, and that's good enough. Like that mixed with the hierarchy, you absolutely hear the structure. It feels very structured. And not only that, but I've separated out the layers so I can choose improvisationally when I'm performing to listen to layer one or two or three, and then I can make like layers four and five more or less loud. I can make all of them more or less loud. And that's reflected also in the visuals, how loud they are.
Hmm. So yeah, there are beautiful visuals that go with Dan's Natural Machines show. Do you want to tell us a bit about how that relates to what you do when you're performing and how they're generated as well?
Yeah, sure. So Natural Machines started as a purely musical project. Just writing these algorithms that improvise with me. It was super, super fun for me. It really turned this instrument that I've been playing my whole life into a brand new instrument. But So as I mentioned earlier, I got into coding as a kid, and then through my teens, I wrote a ton of programs, and they were all visual. I just love visual stuff. Like I coded a 3D renderer and a whole bunch of stuff, like including fractal renderers, and I just loved doing visuals and code. It never even occurred to me to make music with code back then. So of course, here I am now, you know, a couple decades later, writing these algorithms that actually make music, and I'm sitting on all this data, right? Every time I press a note, I'm receiving it as data, and every time the computer plays a note, it's also sending data. I'm sitting on all this. It seems almost criminal not to make
to
some pictures,
yeah.
Not to make some images from it. So I've written all these programs that are also all different in subtle ways, and they represent the music exactly. This is a really important point for me because I think when you mix visuals with music, it's super dangerous. I think we've probably all seen examples of music mashed with visuals where the visuals become very distracting. We're extremely visual animals, so visuals tend to take precedence. And if there's anything happening in the visuals that is kind of like has any kind of narrative form or any kind of independent story, I think the music has a tendency to immediately feel like background music, like film music, mm-hmm. like it's accompanying.
It becomes secondary.
It mm-hmm. becomes kind of trivialized, I think. The composer Don Adams talks about this in his autobiography in the 90s. He did an opera that had visuals, had a video component, and he just found that it was a disaster because it just made the music feel like trivial. And music, as we all know, has the capacity to hold our intention entirely, right? So to me, the solution is to make visuals that represent the music exactly. So if everything that is happening visually is actually something real that is occurring in the music at that very moment, then what you're getting is a kind of a synesthetic experience where the visuals are amplifying what you're hearing in the music. And even more than that, even more than amplifying, they can actually enable you to hear it better. Because, for example, in these algorithms that I've written, there's structure to it. Like, what I'm playing is separate from what the computer is playing. And sometimes the computer is playing several layers of response. It might be responding once and then responding to that. And I can separate all this out visually and make it different colors or different shapes or whatever. So
like a focus almost, helping the audience focus on things? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it can help just understand what's happening in the music. Like, for example, that inversion algorithm that I mentioned, where everything I play is then repeated upside down. I've purposely designed it so that visually it's very obvious, that symmetry is very obvious.
Hmm. Awesome. So this show is going to be at the Planetarium. So I think, if you're going to go, I'm going on Thursday, I'm very excited. You can, it's very immersive, right, I imagine? I guess they're doing the visuals up on the ceiling.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We set up last night. It's super cool.
Oh. Have you done it in a space like that before where it's full blackout?
I've done
blackout?
It once in a planetarium in Oregon right before, in Portland, Oregon, right before the pandemic, like just a couple weeks before the pandemic. And in fact, the folks at the planetarium here were in touch with that planetarium to ask them some questions about how they managed it. So I love that. Apparently there's like an international brotherhood of planetaria.
Of course there is, yeah. You know, that makes sense. I've got a few more questions, but in a few minutes we might throw it to the audience in case people have questions as well. A couple more things about the algorithms that I'm curious about. So, like, once you started developing them, did you find some of them, like, evolved over time as you started working with them, or did they all spawn new little, like a little family of different algorithms, or were there some that you sort of start working with and then realize, oh, this isn't quite as much fun as I thought it would be, or I keep getting the same result every time I play and it ends up being...
Oh, so you're talking about, like, whether the music that emerges evolves, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I find that to be a really fascinating question. So everything I do in Natural Machines is free improvisation. Actually, on the album, the first track, I play over the changes to All the Things You Are, but that's the exception. And when I play live, I just do complete free improvisation. So obviously the music is different every time. But I think what fascinates me is this question of how much do rules determine the vibe of the result. Even if you're playing completely different notes every time, the rules to some extent do have a very strong influence on shaping the result. You know, it's like if you live on Earth and you're just dealing with a certain amount of gravitation and you have to build a bridge, there's certain aspects of the bridge that are going to be the same no matter where it's built. Like those beautiful curves under bridges, under stone bridges, those are kind of, they kind of emerge naturally from the fact that there's gravity. So similarly with the rules that you might use in music, there's things that they will kind of force into being, you know? And then there are other things that they won't. So to answer your question, I've definitely felt that some algorithms are more fertile than others. Some just like lead directly to one thing, and some are like, wait, oh, it could be all these different things. Mm. But on the other hand, even if they do lead directly to one thing, that doesn't mean that I'm playing the same notes. I'll always be playing different notes. And in fact, for me, the challenge is always to try to approach it as if it were the first time that I encountered it. And especially I need to listen to what the computer is doing just as I would another person that I'm playing with. Like the minute I start thinking of it as some kind of background, the whole thing falls apart. It's like really, I need to be very engaged with what it's doing.
Well, it's a dialogue, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Right. Mm. So it's like if you're not listening in a dialogue, it's not
much. It gets
much
weird
fun.
Really quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I had another question about sort of tempo and groove. Like you're talking about how you can switch up, how big or small you're making it. But is there any, can you be elastic with the groove at all? Or do you have to set, like how do you set tempos? Do you set things before you begin? It's a very musician-y question. I'm just curious about the back end of how it all works. How does it work in that way? Can you be elastic apart from changing the sort of scope or the compass? Can you alter the time in other ways, or do you set a tempo before you start?
So it really just depends which algorithm. So for example, I've written a looper that is kind of inspired by guitar loopers and things like that. You know, it's just like where you hit a pedal and you make a loop, except that since I'm dealing with MIDI data rather than sound waves, it's incredibly versatile, and I can like do inversions and all these things. In any case, the point is that when you make a loop, that's, you know, the tempo is whatever you do between the start of the loop and the end of the loop. But I also can speed up the loop and slow it down. And since it's MIDI data, that doesn't actually make it higher pitched or lower pitched. Mm. I can just keep it right there. And I can also just modify everything in whatever way I want. So that's just one example of flexibility in time. But also for some of them, I can actually change the delay between what I'm playing and the computer's response with a volume pedal that I have.
So it doesn't have to be that sort of metric thing that you're talking about before. It can be a bit more elastic.
It can be completely elastic, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's really like in what I was describing before, that metric thing, that's one very explicit constraint that I decided to set on myself for that algorithm. But that's really just an artistic decision at that point. I just think it's really cool. Mm. But that's one choice. And then, like, every one of them can be different. Yeah, so that's what really excites me about this, actually. It's like, first of all, it's pretty new. Like, no one's found the solutions to these things yet. It's very virgin territory. And secondly, like, everything's possible. It's like, the sky's the limit, you know.
On your website, I found these beautiful, in fact, on your album cover, there are these beautiful 3D sculptures that you've made. Mm-hmm. In case anyone hasn't seen it, go and check them out. They're really lovely. Do you want to tell us a bit about those, maybe?
Sure, yeah. So track 2 on the album, Natural Machines, is called Triad Sculpture. And it's really an exploration of a subject that if I start talking about it, it's like we'll be here all day. But it's the interaction between tuning systems, so between just intonation and equal temperament. Well, in fact, so earlier I was talking about how the rules of counterpoint are profound because they're actually grounded in the physics of vibration. Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about the harmonic series?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So for those of you who don't know, the harmonic series is this amazing phenomenon that happens with vibration, which is that in any vibration are contained also the vibrations that are multiples of that vibration. So if I sing like bo, in there bo, there's also bo, which is twice the frequency because it's an octave up, and then there's also bo bo, which is three times the frequency, and then bo, four times, five times, six times, seven times, eight times, nine times. That's all contained. Literally, if you look at bo with a spectrograph, you will see that all those frequencies are in there. So, in other words, all those sounds really belong together in physics. But, I mean, again, this could take all day. But if you tune music the way that it's in some ways meant to be tuned, according to the laws of physics, then what you're using is something called just intonation, where all the relationships between frequencies are whole number ratios. So, for example, if I do a major third, bo he bo he, if I tune that in just intonation, it's actually the frequency of the upper tone is 5/4 the frequency of the lower tone. And if I do a minor third, bo be, that's 6/5. But if you tune music that way, then you run into this problem, and this is something that musicians figured out over many centuries. You run into this problem, which is that your octaves get out of whack. And what it leads to is this problem where you can't modulate. If you tune a piano using just intonation, you can only play in that key. You can only play in that key. You can't play in another key because it sounds terrible. So eventually people figured out this system called equal temperament, which spreads out the errors created by just intonation over the entire octave. And that enables you to play in all the keys. But it's also crazy out of tune compared to just intonation. And you, as a upright bassist, you would know this well because you have the luxury of tuning everything however you want.
Tuning's my life. Yeah.
Us pianists, we don't have that. So anyway, triad sculpture came from this idea of wanting to represent those interactions between frequencies visually. And I came up with this idea of putting each frequency on each axis of three dimensions. And it kind of works out great because we have these three axes in space, X, Y, Z. And the fundamental harmonies that we use in music, the kind of fundamental ones, have three tones, right? So like a major triad or a minor triad. And they generate these very beautiful shapes, I find, when you map them this way. And anyway, eventually I decided to have them 3D printed. So I'll actually have some of these tomorrow. They make for great earrings. I've had them 3D printed. I've actually had them 3D printed in various metals as well, but I have these red PLS ones with me, and they're very cool.
You should check them out. They're just really beautiful. When I first saw it on the cover, I was like, what is that? And then I started doing some research and, you know, sort of stalking you on your website to find out what's going on, and read about them. And, they're really beautiful, really worth having a look at.
Thank you.
Just really quickly before we chuck it to the audience, do you want to quickly tell us a bit about Farplay as well?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So during the pandemic, many of us, I'm sure, I got very frustrated with my inability to connect with other people in a meaningful way. And I got into ultra low latency audio, which is something that actually is a field that's existed for a while, but that nobody was paying attention to before the pandemic, which is investigating the possibility of actually playing music with people through the internet. It turns out that the latencies that you can get, so latency is the delay between you playing on one end and another person hearing it and vice versa. The latencies that you can get through the internet are really low enough to play together. It's really amazing, but depends of course on the distance, because the farther away you are, just by the limitation of the speed of light, you're going to have more latency. But you know, within like 3,000 miles, definitely you can make almost all kinds of music. Within 1,000 miles, you can make every kind of music, including very highly rhythmic music. And so there was a research project out there that I got into. It was open source, and I contributed to it. And it was extremely hard to use. And so one of the other people who was contributing to the project, we decided to make an app that would make this really accessible to everyone. And so we've been working super hard on this for almost 2 years. And it's been out since last November. It's called Farplay. And it's an app that enables you to play music with other people through the internet. And it really works well. So please check it out.
It's all on Dan's website. Go and check it out. Are there any questions from any people in the audience? I think we have a lovely volunteer here with a microphone. Yeah.
I think I'm perhaps channeling Tamara's question from earlier on, which is, what do you do for bass, perhaps?
And for what?
What do you do for bass? Have a bass line? Yeah, because she's a bass player. I'm thinking she was sneaking around to that question when she was asking about pace and rhythm. So that's I'm just sort of making that a bit more explicit, perhaps, whether I'm right or not, I don't know. And are we to assume that this is just a solo performance that you do? Well, a duo, you with your algorithms on the Yamaha, there's no other musicians in there? Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
And with respect to bass lines, I mean, you know, it's one of the great things about playing the piano is that you can create everything right there. It's not going to sound as cool as a real bassist, but we try.
Okay, that was about it. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think there's one up the back.
Oh. Okay, sure.
Yeah, great questions. So first, the randomness. I do use a little bit of randomness. In fact, in some of the algorithms I play with, it's like I have a foot pedal and I can make things random or not. And I love the way that changes the result. On the other hand, I have also just really enjoyed keeping the randomness or the unpredictable elements more in myself. In like the realm of the intuitive and emotional rather than in the computer, because in this project I really try to think of the computer as augmenting what I'm playing as opposed to replacing. I'm not really looking for the computer to be creative. I'm looking for it to just apply these simple rules. So yeah, some randomness, not a lot. I think, you know, eventually I do want to get into neural networks and things like that and see what comes out of it. But I'm actually less enthusiastic about that because I want the artist to be me. Yeah. With regard to your second question, so the music stuff I program in an environment called Super Collider. This is have you heard of it? It's a relatively obscure programming environment that was created in the 90s. It was open sourced at the end of the 90s and has a active but small community of people that keep updating it. And it's really geared towards music programming. It's a completely full-fledged programming language, but there's just tons of libraries for it that are for every aspect of musical making, and the timing mechanisms in it are extremely precise. And it's also it's a live coding environment, which is really fun. Like you can just write a line of code and press enter and it'll, yeah. So that's a lot of fun and it's free. And then the visuals, I've mostly written in an environment called Processing, which you probably have heard of, or it's pretty well known, I guess, it's an environment built over Java that is geared towards visual artists. Also a full-fledged programming environment that makes it very efficient and easy to do things like create a 3D rendering environment, you know, where I can just say like put a cube there, as opposed to having to actually deal with all the technicalities of OpenGL or something like that. And then more recently I've been coding a VR aspect of Natural Machines, and that I'm doing in Unity. Which is the programming language for Unity. Unity is an environment that people write like computer games in, and then the programming language for that is C#.
Can you say, so there's a programming language that's in C#?
Oh yeah, that's like the intersection of the Venn diagram. C#, you know, is a note on the piano, and it's also a programming language.
Oh, cool.
They're completely unrelated, except that they are called C.
By the name.
They have that same name, yeah. There's a whole family of programming languages called that emerged from C. Mm-hmm. So there's a programming language called C. Right. And then there's C++. And there's... Is there C+? No, but, well, I know there's C++, but was there ever a C+? You sure?
I'm a PhD.
Okay. So why do they go straight to C++?
I'm not sure. I think they're
developed by a couple of different groups. Yeah. Well, no, but C++ is on top of C. Yeah, but you can do plus in C though.
Yeah, but C++ is
yeah. No, I realize, but I'm just, well, in any case, who cares? So you got C, C++, and also C#,
right,
are this family of languages that are all based on C. Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Under. Yeah. Oh, sorry, that was French. Just saying 1212 in French. Old habits coming back. Just about what you just said for C++, just had these thoughts. If the way to increment a variable and make it equals +1, then if you want to imagine the next version of a programming language, then you would say C++. That's the way you would call it.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
If the variable was the C representing your language, yeah.
That's a really good point. And actually, also, if you think of C#, in music raises a pitch.
Yeah.
So it's actually very similar to +++.
Yeah, and I feel like the magic happens when programmers are in love with more than just programming, when they are in love with art as well, like Steve Wozniak and things like that. And so that's probably why the creativity here from moving from and calling it C++ instead of C1 or D maybe, and then moving from +++ to Sharp by multiplying it once again in a mirror way to create like a note, you know. Mm. So it just makes it interesting. So interesting.
Yeah. Well, you must be right about that. That's where it comes from. The +++. It's like the next level of C, incrementing C. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a lot of nerds in the audience. Jesus.
Yeah.
This is just like a normal jazz talk. Yeah, this is, we always talk
you guys
about
come
programming.
From?
Did you have another question as well?
This was just a comment on what he said.
This is more of a comment than a question.
This might be our last one, I think, too.
Oh, sorry. Okay. First of all, sorry we were a bit late, and I feel like we arrived right at the interesting time where you use word like magical spirituality and everything. I've been on an interesting spiritual journey in the last few weeks. And then you talked about all the things that's coming into my life, fractals, many other things. But yeah. So my question is actually 2 years ago, I started working on a musical bracelet. The idea was to create a bracelet you could carry with you all the time, sort of electronic bracelet where people will be able to create music wherever they are. So basically, you could open it and morph it into any sort of instrument and play from there. And then the next step was, and a little bit like in Guitar Hero, you would be able to choose a music, you know, if you're not an artist yet, like a musician yet, accomplished in violin or anything, and then you could just say, okay, let's go into violin mode, let's pick this violin music, and I'm going to play, you know, that part. And then, like in Guitar Hero, you would have like a screen that would show you, okay, when this crossed the line, then I'm supposed to how do you say in English? I don't even know. I should have chosen the piano instead of the violin.
Comment tu dis en français?
Okay, yeah, but I mean, it's recorded. It's recorded, so.
Well, if you say it in French, maybe I can translate.
Oh, yeah, cool. Okay. Je ne savais pas que tu parlais français. En gros, comment tu dois frotter la bonne corde sur le violon pour obtenir la note de comme sur Guitar Hero qui traverse.
So just which string of the violin?
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully I don't know if you guys know Guitar Hero. So it's a line. The notes of the songs you've chose going to cross like a ball is going to cross a line. When it crosses the line, it tells you, you know, which note you're supposed to press on the piano or... Mm-hmm. I mean, here it was the guitar.
So it's in time.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was the first idea. So everyone can play music they like on any instrument, just naturally like Guitar Hero. I'm going to try to fast track, sorry. And then from there, the next idea was to actually be able to play, create a song like with different people around you. So I was picturing that bracelet could help create the next Beatles in a schoolyard, you know, like the people just play and improvise or just choose something they like and work it from there. But then the next step was to actually do it over the internet. And of course, there was the challenges of the speed of transmission and everything. And you seem to have started to figure out all these challenges that I have. So I had, and then pandemic with a big cleanup, just dismantled my team and some other challenges. But I'm kind of returning to it now. And so it's just, yeah, I just love the spiritual factor or anything you want to call it that I was thinking I was coming to like hear some jazz music tonight, and instead, I'm just arriving, and it's more of a talk. And you're basically the answer to everything I've been looking for a long time. So it's interesting.
Can I quote you on that?
Yeah.
Dan Tepfer called the answer to everything I've been looking for my whole life.
Yeah, I mean, for...
We'll be playing the Melbourne Jazz Festival.
you can say this to your partner as well.
That's pretty much a great note to end on.
So there's no question, but basically, the co-creation here is just so interesting. Love to talk to you more
it's
about
definitely
it.
It's definitely a fertile ground, that intersection between music and art, music and science and computers in particular, I think, yeah.
Again, have a look at Dan's website. There was a link I saw where you did a live performance with Kristen Barati where she's triggering your piano from remotely and then she's improvising with it over...
I wrote this web interface for her so she was at home in Australia at the time, actually. She was...
Oh, was that before
in
she
Brisbane.
Went to...
Yeah, it was before she moved. And so she opens this web page, which is actually hosted on my server at home, and there's a piano on it, and then she can click notes on the piano, and then my piano that's at home in Brooklyn physically starts tremoloing those notes, and then she can press a button that transforms the pitches. So in other words, it just like will move subtly the harmonies around, and then the game is just for her to improvise over it.
Mm. And she's an incredible singer as well, if anyone doesn't know her.
Yeah, she's ridiculous.
So it's sort of part of what you are, sorry.
It was just so fun to do that between Australia and New York, and it worked really beautifully.
So it's sort of what you're talking about, a bit people playing across in different instruments and in different ways. But definitely go have a look at his website. Natural Machines is, I think there's a few tickets left, is that right, Hadley? Just a few?
For the second sets, right? I'm playing at 7 and 9:30. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And I guess the 7 o'clock sets are sold out, and the 9:30, there's a few tickets left.
I think it is 9 actually.
Oh, is it 9?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So yeah, please come. The next two nights, it's at the Melbourne Planetarium.
Can we all please thank Dan Tepfer for the chat?
That was Dan Tepfer in conversation with Tamara Murphy at the 2022 Melbourne International Jazz Festival, presented with the support of Arts Centre Melbourne. Please keep in touch with Melbourne International Jazz Festival by subscribing to our e-news at melbournejazz.com. Follow us on social media and subscribe on your preferred platform for more podcast episodes. We would like to thank principal partners Creative Victoria and the Australia Council for the Arts. Thanks for listening.